Just, oh, visitors. All right, a couple of things before we move on today. Last Sunday night, I forgot my speech, and I knew there were things I wanted to say I didn't, but again, I want to thank everybody that took time out of their lives to come here to express appreciation, and I know what it is, and it wouldn't matter who was in the office, whether it was me or somebody else. If somebody does the job and does it right for a long time, I suppose it's fine to honor them. But again, we're not islands. We're not lost to ourselves. We're not supposed to be anyway. But there's no such thing as a pastor, really, without a congregation. You know, you can call yourself a shepherd, but without sheep, it's sort of a non-point. It's moot. So I want to thank you guys all again, the people that did the work, that were on the committee, that did all this, got it set up. I thought everything was great, went off very well, so very happy about all that. And then the congregation at large, obviously there is no church if there isn't a flock. And so there is no sound teaching if there isn't people who are positive, who want it. So like, again, a marriage, it's a mutually beneficial relationship, and I'm aware of that. Obviously, too, like a marriage, it can be destroyed by either party. It's not always for life, unfortunately. It's designed to be that way. But unfortunately, as we know, with sin natures and all, anybody could mess anything good up. And I didn't get to do it, she's probably going to be glad I didn't, but I wanted to express gratitude to our daughter Laura, who came here under some less than ideal circumstances, and who has been a real support and really a quality, you know, of the two kids we have. You know, if you ever saw that movie, Dewey Walk Hard, you know, you have this deal where this kid accidentally cuts his brother in half, and his dad's always throughout the movie telling him the wrong kid died. She's been a great support and help throughout all the things we've gone through. And particularly when we had all these, Linda had her four surgeries in 6 months or eight or ten, whatever it was. She was here at least twice taking care of her, doing those things that I needed done. So at any rate, I just wanted to thank you all again and let you know I appreciate it. And those of you who are here from out of town, we're glad you're here. Hope you enjoyed your time. And we can all keep fighting the fight to the very end. Hopefully it won't be too much longer. Since Rosh Hashanah just went past, I don't think the rapture's today, but we don't know. It's not like I'm going to key myself to one day and say it's got to be this day. That's as foolish as setting a date of any kind. So at any rate, just to let you know, hopefully everybody enjoyed their week off and got some time to fellowship with people maybe you won't get to normally and all of that. And as I said, I would rather be with you people than with the finest people on the planet. So. And as it turned out, I found out, didn't find out till just a few minutes ago, but there was a deal because of there was a cash bar there. I'm sure everybody knew that. Apparently, the more you guys drank, the more credit we got back. And so I got another extra little bonus because a bunch of you drank. So may I encourage you in the future. Drink heavily at the cash bar. I'm kidding. All right, well, let's make sure you are in fellowship here, and let's go on. We closed here with the idea that Satan's sin and his rebellion, of course, came out of a perfect environment, so there's far less excuse for his behavior. Any giant of justification would have to go towards man, who has to deal with all of this in a cursed environment. So 9 here, God's perfect love was manifested in his sinless son's undeserved death on the cross, which was also completely consistent with all the other attributes of God's perfect essence. John 3:16, you know by heart, God so loved the world that he gave. That's one manifestation, and one very key manifestation of love is giving. Ephesians 2:4, we saw not all that long ago. In spite of our pre-salvation state, walking around dead in the sphere of our trespasses and sins, and continuing to make that sphere worse by continual sinning. And of course, this is the state of the unbeliever prior to salvation in verses 1 through 3. And he lines up all three critical elements. The age or the spirit of this current world, the cosmic system under the genius of Satan, and again, then Satan himself, the prince of the power of the air, that spirit, which is now working, and of course, our own flesh. We formerly indulged, lived in, exhibited, manifested, and engaged in the lusts of the flesh, indulging the desires of the flesh and of the mind. But God, verse 4, being rich in mercy, because of his great love with which he loved us, acts on our behalf. And then 1 John 4:10. So we have been obviously under grace. And this is really all, frankly, that any of us really know about the actual attribute and expression of love. And is that what we've learned from God? We're not naturally born into this. In this is love. Not that we loved God, but that he loved us and sent his Son to be the propitiation for our sins, satisfying God's righteousness on our behalf. So 10, given this fact, it is quite understandable that Satan would do all that was within his authority and power to thwart the appearance of the seed of the woman, who he feared might destroy the basis for his appeal. And so the promise there in Genesis 4:8 was that Satan would be undone by this human. And of course, the first thing, Cain, who is of the evil one. This is actually detailed for us in 1 John. There's a passage in there that talks about Cain being like Satan and manifesting his father's desires. And so he kills his brother Abel. He was a murderer. Satan was a murderer from the beginning. And Cain falls right in with it. And he rose up against Abel, his brother, and killed him. That was Satan's first attempt to destroy the seed of the woman. And then Genesis 6, 1 and following, that's the second attempt, the second major attempt that we know of. Not to say that there were not others that were not recorded. Satan, no doubt, was working tirelessly at this. But the angelic infiltration into the human race, that was his next attempt to destroy true humanity. And the question becomes, I don't know that we can say 100% for certain, but it seems to me that when it talks about Noah and all being righteous, that number one, he had not been infected by any of this, nor had his family. So that set them apart. Now the question becomes, was there anybody outside of those eight who had not been affected by this? And the answer is truly, we don't know. You can ask the question. But certainly the numbers had to be very, very small. And that true humanity, what we can safely say, was true humanity only came through on the ark. That those eight were the salvation of mankind. And then chapter 11, the next big attempt to destroy all this is the Tower of Babel. As they essentially here, in verse 4, we were given. At first, this is all in complete disregard. I want to point out, too, that God's directive instructions to Noah coming out of the ark were to move abroad, spread abroad, and prosper, and to repopulate the earth, and to spread out over the planet. Well, guess what? They didn't. Mankind just chose to huddle together. It came about as they journeyed literally from the east. They found a plain in the land of Shinar. That's ancient Sumer, essentially where Babylon will be. And in fact, this is where Babylon is built first. And they said in verse 4, come, let us build for ourselves a city and a tower. There's two aspects to the Babylonian rebellion. The city is the political aspect. The tower is the religious aspect. It's a high place. And it was designed, whose top, it says, will reach into heaven. and let us make for ourselves a name. Now, most people read this in English and they say, well, what are they? They're trying to develop this reputation so people will be impressed. Wrong. That's not what it means. Because number one, there was no one else to impress. They were the only ones around. Humanity was all there. The name here has to do with another God. Let us make for ourselves another God. They didn't like this Yahweh that had flooded the earth too much. That bothered them, as one might imagine. And so the idea here was they wanted to form a new religion. And out of the Babylonian system, you get two distinct aspects that have always been visible in it. The first is the political. And the second is the religious. You see this in this Babylon here. You see it in the incarnation under Nebuchadnezzar. He decides that there's going to be a state religion. Again, which prefigures the issues of Antichrist. And so, and you'll see it again in the final incarnation, unfortunately. The U.S., we have our own political process. And then in the Roman Catholic Church, the religious aspect of modern Babylon. And we know that both of those entities meet bad ends, very bad ends. We've just recently spent a whole year reviewing it all and doing it really for the first time for me and some of it. The U.S. and prophecy, and it's bad. It's depressing. It's nothing that I found in there that I thought, oh, good. Other than I knew that these people deserve this. That's the saving grace, I thought. So, and then we'll see, and of course, the European Catholicism does not meet a good end under Antichrist at all. He's going to wipe them out. So, given this fact, again, he wanted to thwart this matter of the seed of the woman. Another big attempt, Matthew chapter 2. This is under Herod. And, of course, those of us who've been around for a while and have the chronology know that, number one, when the wise men come to worship the child, that it's not at his birth. Now, for those of you who are setting up your nativity here pretty soon, just don't put the wise men out there. Just, you know, have them around the block coming or something. You know? So. I know none of you do this. And so they went out, and as it says here, Matthew, well, I don't want to read all of this, verses 1 through 16, but they go in, and Herod hears about it, and so he's curious about what's going to happen. And so coming into the house in verse 11 is the key element here. They came into the house. Number one, they're not in a barn anymore. Number two, we know that we key the birth of Christ to Rosh Hashanah, and he was born in about September, probably. And so this is about a year and a quarter later. And so the child's about one now, or a little over one, probably a year and 3 months or so. Now, this could have very well been around what? The winter solstice. And this would very well coincide with the whole Christmas tradition. Because the people got involved in this. I mean, it was ancient. It goes back, all of this, the Babylonian religions. But in Christianity, as they start to incorporate this stuff, unfortunately, it doesn't work. You shouldn't be incorporating true doctrines with, false ones. But coming into the house, they saw the child with Mary, his mother. And he's also called a child in verse 11. I just actually want to see what that is. Paideon. So it's not Brephos. He's not considered an infant any longer. They use another term for it here. And so then they present their deal there. And of course, Herod finds out about all this. They're warned, the three wise men, as they're called, have been warned by God in a dream not to return. And they went by. They left another way. Went out. And so he tells Joseph, an angel of the Lord appeared in verse 13, says, take the child, get him and go. And so then when Herod saw he'd been tricked, verse 16, he became very enraged and sent and slew all the male children who were in Bethlehem and all its vicinity from two. And people have wondered, some people have wondered, I've even seen it, Why did he pick 2 years and under? Because he was really safely hedging his bets. He knew Jesus was only about a year old, but he didn't want to take any chances. So he knew it had been about a year, roughly. But he didn't want to take any chances, so he killed everybody 2 years and under. And that's why he did that, overkill, to coin a term. So 11 further, once the lineage of Messiah was understood to come through the Jewish people, Satan promoted anti-Semitism as a means of exterminating the Jewish race and to prevent the appearance of the Messiah. We see this in some of the historical books, Esther, for instance, which occurs under the Medo-Persian rule here. Esther 3:6. And this is the wonderful fellow Haman, if you're not familiar with him. And in verse we got here? 6 here. But he disdained to lay hands on Mordecai. Well, here was a problem. There was this Jew named Mordecai. And Mordecai, by the way, there's no new quarterback named Mordecai now, too. If you don't know that, you do. You've learned something new today. So he wouldn't bow down and give homage to this guy. In verse 2. And this really upsets Haman. And he says, so he waits day by day, it goes by to see if Mordecai was standing. He said he wouldn't bow down because he told him he was a Jew. And so when Haman saw Mordecai neither bowed down or paid homage to him, he was filled with rage. But he disdained to lay hands on Mordecai alone, for they told him who the people of Mordecai were. And therefore Haman sought to destroy all the Jews. The people of Mordecai, who were throughout the whole kingdom of Ahasuerus. And so he instigates a formal persecution of the Jews and attempts to wipe out the whole race if he can. That was his deal. Also, Psalm 83 addresses this. O God, verse 1, do not remain quiet. Do not be silent. O God, do not be still. For behold, your enemies make an uproar, and those who hate you have exalted themselves. They make shrewd plans against your people and conspire together against your treasured ones. They have said, come and let us wipe them out as a nation, that the name of Israel be remembered no more. For they have conspired together with one mind against you. They make a covenant. And he lists all these different people here who are engaged in these anti-Semitic type things, approaches. And then Daniel chapter 11, this was another attack. Uh, 31 through 35. And this deals with the attacks under during the intertestamental period, the time between Malachi and the appearance of John the Baptist. During this time, a forced Hellenization was instigated against the Jews under Antiochus Epiphanes. And as a type of Antichrist, he does. In fact, Daniel is very interesting here because the historical aspect is dealt with in chapter 11 from verses 1 through 35. And then at 36, the text leaps to the end times, which is prefigured by Antiochus in the intertestamental period. But it leaps to the end times and starts dealing with the Antichrist and all that he's going to do. And as we know, he's going to strongly persecute the Jewish nation. But it's too late now. She'd already given birth to that son, who was to rule the nations with a rod of iron. And so, but this deals with Antiochus Epiphanes and his attacks on the Jews and the resistance under the Maccabees and all of that. So forces from him will arise, desecrate the sanctuary fortress, and do away with the regular sacrifice. And they will set up the abomination of desolation. And by smooth words he will turn to godlessness those who act wickedly toward the covenant. But the people who know their God will display strength and take action. Those who have insight among the people will give understanding to the many. Yet they will fall by sword, by flame, by captivity, and by plunder for many days. So the point is, throughout history, there have been these waves of anti-Semitism, the latest being the Third Reich. But it's always been under the surface. Again, when we reviewed some of that stuff about the U.S. and prophecy, from what we've been engaged in our earliest days, we've had a history and a pattern of this in some ways. Not explicitly throughout the nation, but in various segments and corners, it's been tolerated. And so we now actually have two senators who are flat out anti-Semites. They don't make no secrets of it. They're very clear. They're probably more, but some of them do not want to make it public. So Satan continues his opposition against Messiah here, point 12, by seeking to thwart the fulfillment of various prophecies related to the church, to the second advent, and to the establishment of Messiah's eternal kingdom. Satan will not. Now, one thing you've got to give him, he's persistent. He hasn't given up yet. 2 Corinthians 2:11 talks about this in terms that he's got these organized strategies. These schemes that he uses to manipulate and control those who he can. So that no advantage, as he says. And one of the big things, of course, here's the problem, is this matter of not forgiving, of unforgiveness. If you let that take root and start letting bitterness develop, and particularly in a local church, this is the death knell of it. This is one of the things that will kill a church, is that believers can't forgive and forget and move on and tolerate each other because we're all so damn cool. Well, we're not. We're all sinners, saved by grace, in need of mercy, and in need of each other, for that matter. So he says here about forgiveness, this matter, so that no advantage would be taken of us by Satan. For we are not ignorant of his schemes. Well, we better not be. We're going to get a big dose of that coming up in Ephesians 6. Also, 11:14, I think this deals with his false apostles. Yeah. Which are just a reflection of Satan himself. He's got a couple of different approaches, obviously. There are probably several, not just two, but certainly two of the major ones are the angel of light approach and the roaring lion approach. One's designed to inspire fear. The other one's designed to get you to trust him. And so he has different approaches he can use to people. Well, no wonder, he says, for even Satan disguises himself as an angel of light. Therefore, it is not surprising if his servants also disguise themselves as servants of righteousness. But whose end will be according to their deeds? God will sort all this out. 1 Thessalonians, also 2:18. And this one's in a little smaller context of simply trying to thwart Paul from getting back to Thessalonica in order to teach these people and instruct them. He was run out of town very quickly after the initial gospel was given there. For we wanted to come to you, I, Paul, more than once. And yet Satan hindered us. So he is actively out there working against whatever God's will may be in a situation. Satan's working against it. And he is tireless. He doesn't get tired, apparently. He's an angel. We have no evidence that they need sleep or anything like that. And so the fact is, and he's got tons of experience. He knows the human race by now. I mean, he could write a book. He knows what the human race is. He knows how to deal with it. He knows the link to evil through the genetics and nature. He's cognizant of all of that. Also, there, 2 Thessalonians 2:9. Next book over. And this gets into the appearance of Antichrist. As we have seen, this is the one who's coming, whose arrival is in accord with the activity of Satan. See, when you think about Antichrist, what you have to realize is him and Satan, although he's human, they're like peas in a pod. They think alike. They have the same idea. And the biggest idea that they share in common is global domination, ruling the planet. This is seen in many tyrants and all and leaders of old. They were going to rule the world. Alexander got the oracle there that told him he was destined to rule the world, the entire world. And he believed it. So this is the one whose coming is in accord with the activity of Satan. Really, probably here better with every miracle signs and false wonders, every type of these things. So when people see the supernatural in action, it's impressive if you ever see a supernatural activity. Miracles, fire being called down from heaven, these types of things. Well, Satan's got supernatural power too, as we know. And that's in some ways, I think the underlying theme of Ephesians, or at least the underlying current, is that we're in this big angelic conflict and these powers have already been defeated, and yet they won't give up. And it's too easy for believers not to recognize their place, their position, their importance, and to blow all this. As we're supposed to give witness for God. So again, this happens to those who perish. You can see we've looked at Revelation 12. There, the warfare. Actually, I think, take that back. This is the direct statement about his anti-Semitic approach after his ejection from the third heaven. After they're kicked out. And particularly, verse 13 is our a big one here. And when the dragon saw that he was thrown down to the earth, he persecuted the woman who gave birth to the male child. And so another heavy wave will come again against the Jews during that time. Antichrist, you can see this in 13, 1 and 2. And then at the end there in chapter 20, 7 through 9, the great Gog-Magog rebellion, where Satan gets out and he has his last hurrah. Well, during the appeal, which is human history, angels are left free to engage in active opposition to God. Isaiah 14, that was the mandate there, or Satan's manifesto, that they're going to soon be like God. They work against the elect angels. We saw that there when the angel was stymied until Michael came and helped him. They work against the people of God. That's seen in Job there, 1 Chronicles 21, 1. We're going to see it coming up in Ephesians 6, 11, that these powers are at work and that these are really our opponents. Our opponents manifest and deal through the human race at some level. But humans are pawns in the game. They're not really the enemy. They may put themselves in positions where, unfortunately, they become the enemy. But we always have to recognize that people are lost, they are stupid, they are in darkness because, one, that's where they choose to be. But two, they are up against forces that are far greater than they are. And they just don't know it. And they go through life and they think they've got it figured out. Well, if you don't have all this in your theology, you don't have it figured out. So they work against the people of God. We'll see those attacks. 1 Timothy 4, 1 through 3, we alluded to this morning. Already as they go after believers who are sound in the faith, apparently. Can one time be sound, hitting on all cylinders, doing the right thing, and gradually get distracted? And it's gradual, it's slow. Now, when the big blow-up comes, everybody goes, what happened? Well, what happened was you're just seeing the final play out of what's been going on for months or years, and sometimes even decades. You'll see it finally play out. And so those people, obviously, because they're people, as he describes them, men who become seared in their conscience. Their conscience won't even allow them to admit the truth about what's going on. They can't see it. They don't want to see it, for one thing. That's an important point. They don't want to see it, but their conscience has been branded. He said, like, seared was with a branding iron. And so their norms and standards begin to take hits. This is one of the problems with not consistently maintaining diligence and zeal is you start compromising just a little here, a little here, a little here. It doesn't seem like much. Doesn't seem important, maybe. But until those things start to pile up, and then suddenly you see somebody and you think, well, what happened? Well, compromising as they went, just small things, maybe you didn't notice it. Then suddenly one day the whole thing goes up. There, and you can also see against the nations as well. These demons are active. Revelation 16, we can look at that, and we're here. But they're busy. They've got a plan. They've got an agenda. 13 and 14. And I saw coming out of the mouth of the dragon, and out of the mouth of the beast, and out of the mouth of the false prophet, three unclean spirits like frogs, for they are spirits of demons, performing signs,
which go out to the kings of the whole world, to gather them together for the war on the great day of God the Almighty. And so one of the things you see that demons are certainly capable of doing is instigating the human race to activities like warfare and things like that. We saw that in the book of Job in that first chapter. Two different groups get riled up and come and attack. And Satan is behind all that. That didn't happen in a vacuum there. Satan was given some leeway and he went out and started working. Worked with the weather to accomplish his stuff that he needed done to attack Job. Well, Jay, they are also free to deceive unbelievers. Luke 8:12, and they do. This should not be, again, new news. Here explained that the birds in the parable are demonic forces. It talks about the birds who come and eat the seed that falls by the wayside on the hard pack. Can't penetrate the ground, can't germinate. So these beside the road are those who have heard. Then the devil comes and takes away the word from their heart, so that they will not believe and be saved. So obviously with any gospel presentation and all that, you've got satanic opposition to all of this, a demonic opposition. And then 2 Corinthians 4:3-4 just says that Satan has these people essentially already where he wants them, these unbelievers. For even if our gospel is veiled, and it is in some cases, it is veiled to those who are perishing. In whose case the God of this world has blinded the minds of the unbelieving so that they might not see the light of the gospel of the glory of Christ, who is the image of God. So they deceive unbelievers and they may be used by God to discipline believers. God can use demons as a part of his overall strategy. He knows what their volition is to do already. The question is, does in certain cases, God doesn't have to overrule them. Luke, here, chapter 8, verse 34 and 35. And this is in a situation where these are apparently Jewish herdsmen raising pigs. Well, that's bad. You're not supposed to be doing that. They were outlawed under the Mosaic Covenant, and these people are still under the Mosaic Law at this time. And so this is when the demons are given a chance. They didn't want him to just cast them out. Apparently, apparently demons seek some sort of host for whatever reason. I don't know what their reasoning is or why. They're never ever happy. They're always out of sorts. They have to be. They're never ever content. Can you imagine that, going through your life and never knowing a moment of contentment? Of just being able to say, oh, well, everything's okay. The demons can never say that. And so apparently they seek some sort of host. And so they were imploring him, verse 31. They ask him, what's their name? And he says there's Legion, for many demons had entered him. And they were imploring him not to command them to go into the abyss. So there was a herd of many swine feeding there on the mountain. And the demons implored them to permit them to enter the swine, and he gave them permission. Apparently, swine don't like demons. And the demons came out of the man and entered the swine, and the herd rushed down the steep bank into the lake and was destroyed. Well, what do we discern from this? Well, we see it in other places too. The demonic activity is manifested in self-destructive behavior. And in this case, killed them all. They went just rushed down and killed themselves. I think that's the lesson is they'd rather be dead than demon possessed. People, if they had any sense, would too, frankly. So they heard this, they saw what happened, they went and reported it out in the country and all of that. And when the people came in to see Jesus and they see this man sitting there clothed and in his right mind, they became very frightened. Yeah, supernatural power on display has a tendency to freak people out. As it should. And also, 1 Corinthians 5:5. Where are we at here? 1 Corinthians 5:5. This is the incestuous Corinthian. He's turned over to Satan for the destruction of his flesh. Divine discipline to the ultimate, where God takes you out of the world. And this is taught in one of those parables too. The parable where the guy, he went and begged this king. He owed him about $30 billion or something. And the king wanted his money, and he said, "I didn't have it, but let it, give me a chance and I'll pay you." And on this parable, that's all about the necessity of forgiveness. He tells you at the end, this guy is turned over to the torturers. Now, it doesn't identify in the parable who the torturers are. But what Jesus closes the parable with is a direct statement. "And thus shall my Father do to every one of you who does not forgive his brother from his heart." And the torturers, in this case, are demonic forces that are able to torment believers because of their lack of forgiveness. And of course, as we know, this is something that will do a church in. One segment of the fallen angels engaged in the sexual infiltration of the human race in Genesis 6. And is currently imprisoned in the section of the earth known as Tartarus. We've seen Genesis 6:1, but our documentation here for Tartarus is in 2 Peter 2:4. For if God did not spare angels when they sinned, but cast them into hell and committed them to pits of darkness. Well, first, you've got to have some overall theology and understanding of history to know that, number one, this isn't all the fallen angels. That all of the angels sinned at one point, but he's talking about a very specific sin. And in fact, in both 2 Peter and Jude, the underlying motif that links all this together is sexual sins. It's Sodom and Gomorrah, it's the angels, and it's the people that came out of Egypt and got involved in this orgiastic activity, that these are sexual crimes for which these are in prison. But he cast them into literally Tartarus and committed them to pits of darkness, reserved for judgment. And Jude 6 is the parallel to that. Satan and his angels continue to have access to heaven throughout human history, which they use to malign believers, insult God, and accuse believers in God's courtroom. Zechariah, Zechariah 3:1. And then he showed me Joshua, the high priest, standing before the angel of the Lord, and Satan standing at his right hand to accuse him. And the Lord said to Satan, "The Lord rebuke you, Satan. Indeed, the Lord who has chosen Jerusalem rebuke you. Is this not a brand plucked from the fire?" And so there's some object lessons in here. But the fact is that these attacks are coming. They're real. Job 1 and 2, we're familiar with that. That all the sons of God came in to present themselves before the Lord again. Was this something that's done frequently or regularly? Were they summoned? We're not really ever told. We're just told that that's the way it was. And then Revelation 12:10, of course, defines that even at the very end, right? During Daniel's 70th week, this is what they do. Here specifically focusing on Satan. For the accuser, verse 10b, the latter part of it here, of our brothers has been thrown down. He who accuses them before our God day and night. And how did they overcome him? Well, because of the sacrifice of the Lamb, Christ's sacrifice that provides a potential for salvation. Because of the word of their testimony, they were witnesses for the truth, and their willingness to sacrifice. These are the key elements of a successful Christian. They did not love their life, even when they faced death. And then around the middle of Daniel's 70th week, I again think it's probably going to be about 5 months previous to that. Because I think it coincides with the ejection of Satan and the demons from heaven and the release of those demon locusts. And then, of course, after 5 months, Antichrist will step in and say, essentially, I've solved it all. And they'll like that because he's going to kill the two witnesses at that time. And that'll be right at the middle of Daniel's 70th week. So Satan and his followers will have their access withdrawn as Michael instigates a forcible battle. Satan didn't have any choice on this one. God said, go sick him, and Michael went. And he was ready to go, it appears. That was kind of, as I read that, I thought, boy, Michael didn't hesitate, didn't say anything, just went. So I got the impression that, you know, there's probably a lot of animosity between these angels by now, you would imagine, over the course of human experience and history. So he instigates a forcible battle and ejects them. At that time, they will be confined to planet Earth for the duration of Daniel's 70th week. That's his third fall. His fourth fall will be then, at the end of that time, thrown into the bottomless, the pit there, the abyss. And then his last fall, the lake of fire. Five falls that correspond with the five I wills of Isaiah. That there is a correlation between these. And although not explicitly stated, it would again be logical and legal to understand that the fallen angels will be incarcerated with Satan during the course of the millennium. Again, not explicit. And this is where, when the text is not explicit, you can draw inferences, but you also have to recognize that's not the same as a proof text. You can make an inference. And I haven't seen any place that would suggest that what goes on with Satan and his destiny isn't the same destiny for the demons. If there's a difference there, I haven't ever seen it anywhere. And so they take him and they throw him into the abyss, Satan there, and sealed it over him. Well, we know that the demons can deceive nations too, and they're not, the nations can't be deceived during this time, apparently. So we would deduce here, again, that they have been incarcerated with Satan. So following their release, Satan and his followers instigate the final human rebellion against God, which God summarily crushes. And at that point, Satan and his demons will be cast into the lake of fire, where they will be confined for eternity. Revelation, we saw that, 20, verses 7 through 10. The ministry now of the elect angels. Having dealt with the third that are fallen, we still have two-thirds of the angels who are obviously alive and well, functioning. While all angels were created to express something of the eternal God, only the elect angels continue to fulfill that function. Part of their function involves the ongoing worship of the eternal one who created all things. Isaiah 6, here in a passage that's most, I think most people are familiar with this, called the Trisagion, which means three holies, and that's what you have here, holy, holy, holy. And again, very much potentially a reference to the triune nature of God, the Father, the Son, and the Spirit, that each of them is holy. And verse 3, one called out to the other, these are the seraphim with six wings. Holy, holy, holy is the Lord of the armies. The whole earth is full of his glory. And this, they appear to be calling back and forth, that this homage and worship of God continues to be going on, ongoing, in fact. Revelation 4:8. We'll see this a lot, particularly at the outset here. But again, to refresh you, Revelation 4 and 5 are essentially timeless. You have the rapture there at the beginning of chapter 4. As John is caught up to the third heaven to prefigure the church being removed. And really, after chapter 3, the church is never mentioned again. In 6 through 19, it disappears somehow. Now, we don't know, but theologians are still arguing over the fact of, well, where does the church go? Well, we don't believe in the rapture, though. Well, you might. You will eventually. Be better to get on top of it now, but they won't. And the four living creatures, each of them having six wings, again, appear somewhat, at least in form, like the seraphim, are full of eyes around and within, symbolizing their extreme intelligence and understanding and knowledge. And day and night, they do not cease to say, holy, holy, holy is the Lord God, the Almighty, the one who was and who is to come. And when the living creatures give glory and honor and thanks to him who sits on the throne, to him who lives forever and ever, the 24 elders will fall down before him who sits on the throne and will worship him who lives forever and ever and will cast their crowns before the throne. And the idea here is, again, So far as I understand it, the 24 elders and essentially represent the church as the corporate leadership, just as they had in these divisions of the way they had to set up worship under the priesthood was there are 24 divisions under the priesthood. And if this looks to be because the very term elders has church age significance. So I believe these to be 24 pastor teachers throughout the course of the church age, whoever there are. My old joke's always been, hi, Ron Snyder, 25th elder, you know. So I might not make it 24, but you missed it by that much. So, but that's the goal. If you're a pastor, I would think that'd be what you'd want to aspire to. But the casting down of their crowns rather before the throne. These are the Stephanos, the victor's wreaths. And this is a way of saying, a physical representation of, we owe everything to you. It's all you. It's not us. We cast our very rewards before you because you are the one who is worthy. And we rejoice in that. And 5:11, the next chapter. And then I looked, and I heard the voice of many angels around the throne, and living creatures, and the elders. And the number of them was myriads of myriads, and thousands of thousands, saying with a loud voice, worthy is the Lamb that was slain, to receive power and riches and wisdom and might and honor and glory and blessing. And all of this is going to be continued. We'll see this as why they were created at some level, the angels. And some of them will continue to engage in it. They'll fulfill their function. See, God may choose to use angels as a physical means of transport in spite of the fact that he is omnipresent. This is, I suspect, somewhat language of accommodation because God doesn't need anything to get around. And so he never buys a car or a Segway or anything like that, a skateboard to get around, airplane. He doesn't need any of that. But he apparently chooses to use these angels sometimes in this way. Or again, this is physical language depicting something else. It looks to be a judgment. So he rode upon a cherub, and he flew. He sped on the wings of the wind. So again, whether this is language of accommodation or he chooses to use angels at some points for his means of transport, that's up to God. And he certainly could. There's nothing wrong with it. So elect angels have a ministry toward believers and may be dispatched to protect or deliver God's people. Psalm 91, we know that they are ministering spirits sent out to render service for those who would inherit salvation. So what all are they doing? I don't know. They never report to me. I don't know what all they're doing. They may, I've had times, I suspect it was my guardian angel. God knew I was positive, but even when I was an unbeliever, and I had a choice that day before I got on that motorcycle. Should I wear a helmet or not? I swear, this was the one time I actually did almost hear an audible voice. The impression was so strong and so powerful, wear the helmet. And again, 5 minutes later, I would have been in hell if I hadn't. It was just that quick and that simple. And there were huge gashes out of the side of this helmet where it pounded the pavement. Well, that would have been my head. And I don't even like thinking about it now. It's a little scary to think you were that close to hell. A little frightening. But I suspect that day, I think that was probably my guardian angel. Watched over me and saved me because I'd been too stupid. Because they just passed the no helmet law and you wanted to be cool. So wearing a helmet wasn't cool. So here, Psalm 90, and again, of course, this is messianic as well, but applies in larger measure. For he will give his angels charge concerning you, to guard you in all your ways. They will bear you up in their hands, that you do not strike your foot against a stone. And so what all do angels do? I don't know. An angel may whisper in your head, take this route. I don't know what all they do. You may miss something horrible. By just they've got you in the right place at the right time. It's hard to say what all they do. I've had a couple of incidents, that one there. And then there was one when we were up in Colorado, up on the Big Blue up there. And Laura must have been, I don't know how old she was. She couldn't have been more than 8 or 9, I don't guess. And we were up there, and she wandered off and got lost. And nobody could find her. And all of a sudden, she said, this man just walked up to her and said, are you okay? And she goes, no. He said, well, let's go back this way. And he walks her back. And then they see her, and this guy just disappears. So was it an angel? I don't know. But the fact is, I've heard things like that from other people. But that one affected me. So what all do they do? And again, as you see with Jesus, when even though he knows he's got angels that are watching over him, he said, do you not think I can call the Father and get a legion of angels here right now? He knew all this. But he didn't use this as a way of tempting God, of testing God, saying, well, I've got an angel, I can do anything I want. I'll be safe. So don't take that approach. I've got a guardian angel, I'm fine. Daniel, here, chapter 6, 22. Daniel gives testimony to this. My God sent his angel. And he shut the lion's mouths, and they have not harmed me. And again, the liberal interpretations of all this are funny. You know, this isn't a miracle. The lions just weren't hungry that night, or something was going on, or, you know, I don't know. They got all kinds of rationalistic explanations. But they were sure hungry the next morning when they threw these people in, because they had not reached the bottom in verse 24 before the lions overpowered them and crushed all their bones. So the idea that there was no miracle here, no, there was a miracle. And he attributes it to a guardian angel. And our last one here today, Acts chapter 12. This is probably, I think, when... Peter was in prison, and this angel gets him up, shows up there. And in verse 6, this was, people say, well, this can't be supernatural. Well, Peter's sleeping between two soldiers bound with two chains. And guards in front of the door were watching over the prison. And if you know anything about a Roman prison here, you know that guards don't fall asleep on duty. But once. Mm-hmm. One time they might. And behold, an angel of the Lord, verse 7, suddenly appeared, and a light shone in the cell. And he struck Peter's side and woke him, saying, get up quickly. And his chains fell off his hands. And the angel says, put your clothes on and put on your sandals. And he did so and said, wrap your cloak around you and follow me. And he went out and continued to follow, and did not know that what was being done by the angel was real. For he thought he was seeing a vision. And they passed by the first and the second guard. And each time the angels would say, these are not the droids you're looking for. And got them out of there. And so he takes them out, and they went along one street, and immediately the angel departed from him. And when Peter came to himself, he said, now I know for sure that the Lord has sent forth his angel and rescued me from the hand of Herod and from all that the Jewish people were expecting. Okay, well, time's gone. We will stop there today and continue here on Tuesday. Thank you, Heavenly Father, for the opportunity to fellowship in the things of your plan. We pray that you would sanctify this information to our spiritual growth and future glory, for we ask it in Christ's name. Amen.